Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at their carbon-neutral Eco Brew Pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver, available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com. We're going to hear one announcement, and then we're going to go right to the food show.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Cross Cultural Rhythms at the 40th Avenue Garage, a showcase of music, dance, and spoken word performances, all sharing roots in African culture. Cross Cultural Rhythms will take place on Saturday, October 18th from 7 to 10 p.m. at the 40th Avenue Garage, 1711 Southeast 40th Avenue in Portland. This is a benefit for the Obo Addy Legacy Project. Confirmed performances include Ghanaian drumming and dance, South African boot dance and music, multiple spoken word artists, and more. Again, that's Cross Cultural Rhythms, Saturday, October 18th from 7 to 10 p.m. at the 40th Avenue Garage in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to the KBOO Food Show. I'm your host, Chris Siegel. Today on the show, we'll be learning about a brand new publication called Render. It's a quarterly magazine focused on telling stories about food and feminism. We also have a conversation with Ian Harris about the art of Dutch oven cooking. He'll tell us one of his favorite and most foolproof Dutch oven recipes. To finish off the hour, we'll have Jesse Friedman and Laura Haddon in the studio to talk about their dinner series, United Noshes. They are raising money for hunger prevention organizations by staging dinners representing every United Nations delegate. They are currently in the K's. The next meal is Kazakhstan. But first, it's that time of year for the annual Portland Fermentation Festival. We have one of the organizers of the event, David Barber, with us in the studio. Along with organizing the Portland Fermentation Festival, David is also a chef and owner of Pickleopolis, the Kingdom of the Brine, and Bingo Sandwiches. David, welcome to the food show.
Oh, thanks for having me, Chris.
So what can folks who attend the Portland Fermentation Festival expect?
Well, it's usually if you haven't been there before, people get pretty blown away by it. In the last 2 years, we started doing two tastings. It's basically a group of about 20 to 25 exhibitors showing the kombucha, krauts, all sorts of different things, fermented meats, sausages, etc. And they're all set up doing little cup samples. It seems to always be like a pretty warm afternoon, warm evening, so the place gets pretty fermenty. It's really delicious. It's like really high energy, fun event. And now we have up on the roof at EcoTrust food and beer and cider for sale. So it's a pretty good evening.
And I would think that a lot of these food festivals feature folks who have like professional businesses and whatnot, but it sounds like this festival is a little bit different.
Yeah, we like to have a good mix of professional and amateur. The way we started out was we got a call from our friend Sandra Katz, who we all kind of knew from different paths, and that he was going to be in town and wanted to know if we wanted to put together an event with him. So it was mostly, there were some professional people like myself and then a bunch of amateur people who had just, hung out with him and had these little home parties. And the first year was a pretty diverse group. And by the second and third year, it whittled down to just myself, Liz Crane, who writes the Food Lover's Guide to Portland, and George Winborn. And and since then, we've been organizing it, the three of us. And so we like to have a really good mix of amateur and professional, so everybody can kind of feed off of each other. And the pros get a lot of tips from the amateurs, and likewise.
So when you were starting, you were kind of throwing a party with Sander to sort of celebrate fermentation. What did you see for it in the future? Was that just sort of a one-off thing? And you were like, oh, this is pretty neat. Let's keep doing it.
It was so the first year we did it. We've done it at EcoTrust. They've been our main kind of sponsor and cheerleader on this thing from the beginning. And it was such a phenomenal turnout that we were like, we have to do this all the time. And we had Sander again last year to pump it up. But even in the convening years without him, it's just been a really great, well-attended event.
And so I want to talk about you personally. Obviously, you were a part of that first group, but how did you come to fermentation and pickling?
I've always been interested in cooking. Since I was a little kid, I made, like one of the very first things I ever made was watermelon rind, pickled watermelon rind with my dad. And then I had a long career as a chef and restaurateur. I started Three Square Grill here in Portland in 1995. And we were open for 17 years. And in 2004, we got together with a local farmer and started, and I'd always done pickles, always done fermented foods and pickles in the restaurant. And we hooked up with a farmer that had a booth at the farmer's market and made a bunch of stuff and jarred it and got it out there. And it pretty much took off. So it was it was like a sister operation from the restaurant for a while, and then I've been doing it full time for the last 3 years.
And it sounds like you've transitioned from having the restaurant now to just focusing on the business, Pickleopolis.
Right. Yeah. So pickles, and then also we do Bingo Sandwich, which is a sandwich stand at the Portland Farmers Market on Saturday and Wednesdays.
So leading up to this event, I was checking out the website, and I noticed at the bottom of the website, there's a short paragraph that you'd have to, kind of go through all the links, you go through all the information, and you get to it, and it's this sort of call for fermenters and picklers. It's a call about maybe forming a guild in Portland, and so I was wondering if you could tell us the idea behind forming a guild.
Yeah, so we've had that link up since the beginning, and it pretty much, we, as far as having like an organized guild, I don't know if that's ever going to happen, but what we do get is people that want to be part of the Fermentation Festival writ large in October, and then also smaller house parties, which we do and encourage people to do that. And that's kind of like what our guild is.
And do you see, what is it about Portland that allows, because this is a sort of a very specific, and I know that's what guilds are in general, they're very specific, but what is it about Portland that it can maintain, its own fermentation festival, its own sort of guild, people committed to fermentation?
Well, it's interesting because there's a lot of crafty stuff here, and it's kind of the focused slacker DIY ethos of it. And it's food, so it's visceral. It's people, people enjoy it, and it's making something really interesting on a small scale, or large scale, that people can get around, stand around and talk about and enjoy.
And also, I feel like there is some marketing that can happen with fermentation, and clearly you go to the grocery and you buy fermented goods, but there is something about it that it is more sort of made for the home cook, home person.
I mean, the thing with fermented foods is they're generally, they're always going to be a refrigerated item, which is kind of dear space in a grocery store. And it works well to having at home. Does not work well to doing on a really big, industrial scale. Mm-hmm. So it does kind of lend itself to have being a more personal, smaller scale thing.
Yeah. I was just having a conversation last night with somebody who had been in Korea recently, and she said they have two refrigerators in their households, right. And one is for most of their, refrigerated goods, and the other one is only for their kimchi. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if that's similar in your household. If you've got
our house, everything smells like pickles.
Mm-hmm.
And in our kitchen, like the walk-in is just blasted. And the rest of the place too. I mean, it smells pretty good.
Sure. Now, as we're getting ready for the festival, I'm wondering if there's anything that you've had recently or tried making that has reinvigorated your excitement for fermented foods.
Well, we just did. Every year we get, we get lots of different peppers. This is the first year. We've always done these little red cherry bomb peppers, which we just pulled out of. We just fermented them, and they just came out so amazing. They're just hot little round red bombs. I brought you some here, but we're going to be sampling them at the festival tomorrow. And that's kind of we just pulled them out of the ferment, and I wasn't sure if they were going to be mushy or crispy or whatever. And they're just beautiful.
They're spot on.
Pretty happy with them.
Yeah. And so that's one thing that's coming up with the festival that you're excited about. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if there's anything else that you know of that's going to be there that's getting you excited for tomorrow evening.
Every year, it's the one, pretty much the one time of the year that I get to eat natto. And which, if anybody hasn't tried natto, please come and try Heidi Nessler's natto. She's going to be doing a demo. We're going to have a bunch of demos at the show.
Could you tell us what natto is?
It's fermented soybean, and it's huge in Japan. They eat it for breakfast, and it's one of those things that is such an acquired taste. It's slimy. It's smelly. It's like leaves like strands of webs, when you have to pull it apart to see if it's ready. And it's really delicious. And so we're going to have that there. We have about six people doing demos at the event. Heidi's going to be doing natto, Gabe from Biwa, bunch of other stuff. And, we're also going to do an extra a question answer thing with an expert panel, which is going to be with Reverend Nat Sider, Commons Brewery, Eric from Chop Butchery, and myself. So it's going to be a lot of fun. It'll be really diverse, and it might probably be too short of a panel, but it's going to be fun. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is people come to the event and they can go to a particular exhibitor or company and ask any question about how to make the stuff, and we're very free with it. It's the thing of we're giving out the information.
Yeah, sounds like there's a lot of sharing, only of the like actual physical, foods, but then also the
information. I learn something every year, and it's so much fun.
So give me the details then. We've talked about the event, but how do people attend? What?
So we have
time.
We're doing two sets of tastings. The show starts at 6 o'clock, and the expert panel thing is at from 6 to 7, and then from 7 to 8 is the first tasting, and then 8 until 9:30 is the second. And you can get tickets at our website, which is portlandfermentationfestival.com. The first set, as far as the 6 o'clock and the 7 o'clock, are pretty getting filled up. But tickets are still available online. And then for the second tasting at 8, it's wide open.
So people could show up if they wanted to.
People can show up, yeah. And it's always been the case. And we have, at the show, I think we do cash only. There's an ATM machine, and we have plenty of change. And, again, it's just a lot of fun.
Great. And then people can come there and find out more about you, in particular mm-hmm. in Pickleopolis, but where outside of the fermentation festival can they
So
find
we do mostly wholesale. We're at a lot of sandwich places and restaurants, Monk Sandwich, Meat Cheese Bread, Devil's Dill, and more that I'm blanking on, Besaws. We have all our stuff in those places, and then we have our stuff for retail sale at Shut Up and Eat on on 39th Southeast. And then we also have everything for sale at the Portland Farmers Market on Saturdays and Wednesdays.
Great. Well, I'm going to give you one last chance, the final fermentation pitch for the Portland Fermentation Festival.
Come, have fun, be stinky, and go home happy.
Great. If that didn't get you, if you weren't going before, I hope that that last pitch will have gotten you there. So thanks for coming on the food show, David.
Thanks for having me, man. It's great.
That was David Barber, owner of Pickleopolis and one of the organizers of the Portland Fermentation Festival. For more information about the Portland Fermentation Festival, you can visit the food show page on the KBOO website. We now turn to a new publication in town. Rinder is a quarterly magazine that focuses on the intersection of food and feminism. The writers for the magazine take a look at food through a different lens, forcing us to think about the impact of what and how we eat. I recently sat down with founder and creative director Gabby DeLeon and executive director Danielle Knott to talk about the magazine. The interview was recorded at the KBOO Studios.
I'm Gabby DeLeon, and I'm the creative director and founder of Render Feminist Food and Culture Quarterly.
And I'm Danielle Knott, and I'm the executive director of Render Feminist Food and Culture Quarterly.
We'll get to the magazine itself, but why focus on food and feminism?
When I was developing my thesis, I just wanted to make a food magazine, and I was like, I was inspired by Lucky Peach and Bon Appetit, and I was like, well, how am I going to make this different? Like, how is this going to stand out in the market? Everything is kind of the same these days. So I started working at Bitch Magazine, which is a feminist response to pop culture, and started learning about feminism there. And at the same time, I was also thinking about how women have such a complicated relationship with food. I mean, everyone does at this point, but women especially. So I started focusing on the woman's experience with food. I was focusing on like my personal experience, and I was like, well, why does that matter? Like, if it's an issue for me, it's probably an issue for a lot of people. So I opened it up and wanted to just make it a, you know, discussion of food and feminism.
It does seem like a specific niche, albeit one that I'm definitely interested in, and I'm excited to see the magazine. Do you think you're going to have an audience to support the publication?
Yes, we do have an audience already, and it's pretty inspiring. When we first started the magazine, or when I first got involved, I was in an entrepreneurship program, and it was not... I mean, the response I got from all of the people in the business school was like, why are you doing this? You're not going to make any money, and you, like, that's... print is dead.
Feminism. But, no one's going to want to hear about that.
Yeah. And because it is combining two very niche markets already, to create an even smaller market.
Nichier?
I don't know. Yeah. But it's incredible how many people, when they first find out about the magazine, are just like, oh my God, like a feminist food magazine? Why hasn't this existed before? Like, these are my two favorite things. And I think that we're really catering to a group of people who are already engaging in these conversations, but are finding the articles that we're putting out there just on very sporadic sources. So we kind of just are taking what's out there already, the conversations that are already being had, and consolidating them into like one nice, well-designed package. So, during our Kickstarter, we had people who were subscribing from all over the world. And that's really kind of the direction we're headed. So,
well, and at this point, we have over like 200 subscribers, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, sounds like a great start. And it does seem like this, it is a sort of synthesis. So a lot of, I don't know, a lot of issues in food and issues in feminism can be seen in a vacuum. So you're just taking them and you're just putting them together and, yeah, and showing them in sort of a different light.
Mm-hmm.
Why make a print magazine? Why not just do an online magazine or online blog?
As an illustrator and designer, a lot of the inspiration for making a magazine came from other magazines, and the fact that like print, yeah, maybe print is dead, but like, I feel like cookbooks are having a like a huge boom. Cookbooks and food magazines, like, you know, that's the first thing I see when I walk into Powell's in the orange room. Like, that's all there is. It's like this, you know, massive bookcases of cookbooks. And then, you know, there's food magazines everywhere. And it's kind of a, I feel like food magazines are kind of a more boutique thing now. Like, everyone kind of covets them and they're all so beautiful. And like, I guess they're combining like, you know, well-designed magazine with, you know, well-designed, like thought out food, which is pretty cool. But I was like, you know, this, you know, print isn't dead as far as food goes. Like, I can do this too. I just have to like make it stand out and do something really different. And I think because it, you know, food and feminism is such a new concept, like to have in the food market, that it was going to stand out really well. And it did. So,
and also, the idea of Render is for it to really be, a part of every aspect of food and food production. So we have a lot of personal essays and experiences in it. And something that we hope inspires people is using the actual magazine to cook from, which you can, you know, always pull up a recipe or whatever on something that is electronic. But we have space for you to write down your own comments and notes in the ledger of the actual magazine, which is really just reinforcing that connection that people have with the content that's in the magazine and encouraging you to use it and to really kind of get dirty with it. So,
well, I don't want to get too deep into the business model, but I'm sure it's probably at this point it's new and somewhat DIY. So that probably helps that you're able to, you know, kind of keep overhead costs down and be able to do sort of smaller runs of this beautiful magazine and not, you know, lose money.
A lot of similar publications are very much either in the print world or the digital world, because I think that there's this tension. But for us to make it accessible and keep it at a low cost and make sure that as many people that want to read the magazine can, we offer it in both print and digital. So it's the same price, but it's your choice. You know, if you want that mobility that you think you can't get with a print magazine, you can have it on a reader or something like that. And it also is a way for us, I mean, we have to, you know, pay a certain amount just to have it printed, but it doesn't really cost us much to have it as a digital copy. So it's a way for us to kind of cater to both groups of people's needs.
So getting into the content of the magazine, could you give us an example of an article or, you know, an example of where food and feminism overlap?
Well, in the first issue, we have an interview with Camus Davis of the Portland Meat Collective. And with that article, it's a pretty long form interview. But I think there it's just like, let's show off like the women that are actually in food culture that we don't hear about very much because it's such a, you know, male dominated industry. And then we also have an article by our own editor in chief, Dr. Lisa Nisley, called Fat Foodie. And it's about, you know, being a larger person and, you know, being a foodie and how that's like problematic.
The article Fat Foodie that Lisa wrote is a really, I think, good representation of the sort of stuff that you won't find in any other food magazine, because she really tackles the, as Gabby mentioned, problematic relationship that people are larger experience being involved in the foodie culture, because there's such an emphasis on self-control and restraint and really refining your palate through this disciplined and regimented like taste and things like that. So we felt like it was a privilege to publish something that a lot of people like her could relate to. And then we also have another piece that deals with masculinity in the paleo diet, the author really discussed how certain like diet trends can really influence your even your gender identity and threaten it or be kind of there's a tension there. So we also have recipes and things like that in the magazine, but the articles themselves are approach food from a more, I guess, political perspective than other food magazines do.
That's interesting to me because I have every content I've seen about the paleo diet has been from like a male perspective, and it's just interesting to think about, well, like the woman who practices the paleo diet, like what that experience is. Mm-hmm. I don't even know what that is because you've just never presented with anything like that.
Mm-hmm. We had two pieces that were in the flesh issue on the paleo diet, and one was more about how people that are able to subscribe to the paleo diet regimen are also coming from a place of privilege, because it's all about access to food and the types of food that you're putting in your body. There's a lot more than just going to a grocery store and getting it. Where does it come from, and who is producing it? So in that way, we're also touching on the economics and class involvement in food production and consumption too.
I mean, this is an aside, but I remember somebody who is on the paleo diet and he was getting like kangaroo meat shipped vacuum sealed from somewhere. So
that's so bad.
It's so bad. Yeah.
Oh, no.
So what do you want to accomplish with Render? Where do you see it 5 years from now?
5 years from now, I'd like to see it still being published quarterly and nice and smoothly. And I'd like to see it nice and big at like 80 pages an issue.
Perfect binding.
Yeah, perfect bound, all those beautiful things. But I'd also like to see a lot bigger readership, of course. And I'd like to see that our readers are feeling empowered by the magazine. And I think that's, you know, one of my missions with it was like, you know, I want people to get educated about food and understand it from all these different perspectives, but I also want people to like get comfortable with it because I had and still have such an issue and such discomfort with like even just deciding what to eat every day. I don't want anyone else to have to experience that, even if they don't have an eating disorder. Like, there's still a lot of question about what you should and shouldn't be eating, especially in America, and I just don't want anyone else to have to do that. And so I think with the magazine, I want people to feel educated and empowered and to be aware of the women that are doing amazing things in the food industry as well. And I want people to feel comfortable with cooking as well. Like the whole, you know, it's the magazine's like half discussion, half cookbook. So, you know, there's recipes back there that are not necessarily dumbed down, but they're just like understandable. And, you don't have to be like an expert cook to like know how to make any of these delicious things. Like, we're gonna tell you how to do it. Like, this is how you make, you know, all these different things, and you should feel comfortable making things in the kitchen and making your food and getting connected with it.
Mm-hmm. How will you know that you're successful? You know, what kind of feedback do you want to receive to know that you've actually made an impact with the magazine?
Well, we've received a lot of positive feedback already from the readers that have gotten the first issue and the people that follow us on the blog, because we have a lot of great columns on that as well. But something that we're planning on doing with each issue release is hosting some sort of dinner series. This last month, at the end of September, we hosted a really beautiful dinner featuring Chef Kasuma Rao's cooking. She owns a food production or culinary company called Rushikala, and partnered with a female winemaker. And as part of our feminism, or my personal feminism and involvement in the magazine, is direct action, which I think is really showcasing and highlighting the contributions made by women in the food industry and being able to promote their awesome, amazing food and wine and things like that. So with each issue, we would love to see more people coming out to those events and really taking an active role in in making sure that the women involved in the local food scene are supported.
So you sort of see a community sort of building up around Render.
Yeah. Well, yeah, a network would be a really great way of describing it. We plan on releasing the second issue in New York, which is going to be a great opportunity for us to build a network there as well.
So you've talked a little bit about the first issue. What's coming up with the next issue of the magazine?
So the next issue, which will be out at the beginning of December, is roots themed, and it's coming at a time where there's a lot of family events and, you know, root vegetables are being consumed heavily. And then we have a timing issue coming out in the spring. And then our fourth issue, which will be out in summer of 2015, is all about transit. So it's kind of our take on the travel issue, but interpreting food transit in a way that's a little bit, and the transit of people differently. So
the last question is, where can folks get a copy of Render?
Right now, the magazine is exclusively available on our website, renderfoodmag.com/store. You can get it in print and digital there.
And we'll be releasing an official stock list with the second issue. So we'd like to be in small independent bookstores in Portland and with the second issue in New York and a select other stores around the country, and hopefully be international within the next couple of years.
Gabby and Danielle, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. That was Gabby DeLeon and Danielle Knott from the new Food and Feminism quarterly, Render. For more information about the magazine, you can visit the Food Show page on the KBOO website. Also, Gabby told a story about the therapeutic impact of taking a butchering class that is going to be featured on the Underground Airwaves podcast that I produce with Edible Portland. Information about that can also be found on the Food Show page of the KBOO website. When I think of fall, I oftentimes think about camping, maybe not on rainy days like today, but this seems like such a perfect time of year to go camping. The mosquito populations are down, it's perfect weather to sit by a fire and share stories, and there are still plenty of nice weekends to get out and explore. When I'm camping, one of my favorite activities is cooking in a Dutch oven. I recently talked with Ian Harris, an avid Dutch oven user, about the cooking tool and one of his favorite recipes. The interview was recorded in the KBOO studios.
I'm Ian Harris. I'm the author of the Dutch Loven cookbook, which I think there's 8 or 10 copies of the Dutch Loven cookbook in existence. I have it here with me today. And I'm also the author of the blog Opry Ski Instructor. It's opryskiinstructor@tumblr.com. Honestly, most of the times that I'm probably, you know, 80% of the time when I'm cooking, like camp cooking, I'm doing it in my backyard because I like it. Really is a very, it's totally practical. Like in the summer, it's really practical because you can bake and, you know, slow cook things without heating up the house. I mean, I guess the main thing about the thing I would say about Dutch oven cooking is that it's this kind of like monolithic thing, like the idea that you can get all your cooking done like in a, you know, a single cast iron pot, you know, just using some coals from the fire. There's something kind of singular and simple about it that is really attractive, and it just kind of sorts out all of the busyness of that we sometimes experience in the kitchen at home, you know, like. I kind of tend to be kind of the cook that like dirties every pan in the kitchen. So it's a good chance to sort of pare things down and just, you know, where you have to be disciplined and you have to be efficient, I think, when you're cooking in that style and kind of, I mean, you have to be mindful of those things, but at the same time, it's very, you know, obviously it's a very, you know, ordinarily when you're cooking in Dutch ovens, you're out in nature and you're kind of, and it's part of that larger experience.
When I think of Dutch oven cooking, I think of being in the Boy Scouts, and one of our favorite dishes was Dutch oven pizza. And I and it was great. It was so delicious. But I know that every time we made it, all the ingredients just ended up sort of melding together and it became this like pizza stew. And so I'm wondering if you've been able to sort of tackle the more like nuances of Dutch oven cooking and like made things that are a bit more sophisticated than a pizza stew.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, the Boy Scouts have always been the Boy Scouts are one of the keepers of the Philosopher's Stone, I guess. So the Dutch oven itself is sort of like the Philosopher's Stone of cooking for that reason, that it's this really like simple object, but but it can do really anything that you want it to do. You can make pizzas, Boy Scout pizzas, stew in it. You can make you can bake bread and bake your biscuits and, you know, fry your eggs and bacon on the lid of it, and you can make, you know, lasagna and fry chicken wings in it. And, it, you know, it can do everything that you want it to do. I think that's why it's so associated with the Boy Scouts and so associated with river rafters and, you know, old busted, you know, bachelor prospectors. And because it's this, like, it's the ultimate bachelor kind of cooking kit that, you know, otherwise you'd have, you know, to kind of make up for it, you'd have a really crazy big kitchen kit.
So it's like an oven, it's a stovetop, it's right. Sort of all these different like methods of cooking all in one right. Blunt object.
Yeah, one blunt object, heavy blunt object, exactly. And there should be an infomercial about it, actually. Like,
well, you know, I feel like we're ready for the Dutch oven renaissance. It's coming.
Cut through a can, like, no problem, and then create make a lasagna in it right after. But in a lot of ways, I think that it's an extraordinarily, I think Boy Scouts are just probably doing it wrong, but it's a really pretty forgiving like cooking medium. I found, I think that you, once you have the kind of just this sort of spirit of it and the feeling of it, I think that you know, you can get away with a lot in a Dutch oven. You can really, I mean, you can make really extraordinary things to eat when you're out of doors. And it doesn't hurt that when you're camping and out of doors, like, expectations tend to be pretty low about cuisine. You know, there's like that old adage about how everything tastes better, and you know, when you're camping or when you're outside. And so that forgiveness part, I think, is like a really crucial part of Dutch oven cooking. Like, it maybe if you were cooking in Dutch ovens and then serving at, you know, at local hotspots in Portland, it would you know, people would be cringing about it. But I found that it's been like, I mean, I've had some things go wrong, but I think that it there's something miraculous about it. You know, like, you put the lid on it, you put the coals under it and on top of it, and somehow it always seems to work.
I do feel like you said that about local hotspots. I feel like there could be a place where that could be their shtick. Yeah. They cook everything in Dutch ovens, and so I give you permission, if you're listening to this and want to start a Dutch oven restaurant.
No, you don't have permission.
Right, okay, you don't have permission. Ask me first. You got to cut Ian and I in on this business venture.
No, it's a good idea. I'm ripping up and remodeling my kitchen right now all by myself, and I have a good friend, Dave, who is who knows that I'm into Dutch oven camp cooking, and he was like, "Oh, you're remodeling your kitchen? Are you putting in like an ash pit and a, you know, like a rock ring?" So this is the recipe for camp, my famous recipe for camp Dutch oven chili verde, which I think is probably if I had to recommend like a thing that you would just sort of casually throw together in your camp Dutch oven, you know, while you were camping with your friends, this would be the thing to do, because it's pretty darn easy to pull off, and everybody will be totally impressed. And the idea with chili verde is that it's like a kind of 3-hour slow simmered, you know, braise, so the pork and the chili verde will get, you know, nice and soft, and all the vegetables, like all the tomatillos and the chiles, will kind of turn into a sauce, more or less. So everything ends up sort of disintegrating, which means that the prep can be pretty crude. Like, you don't have to you know, mince anything. Everything can be really rough cut. So to make a Camp Dutch Oven Chili Verde, you'll start with a big boneless pork shoulder, which you'll cut into like marshmallow-sized pieces, big marshmallows, not little ones. And you'll begin by getting your 12-inch Dutch oven roaring hot under about 20 or 30 charcoals. You'll pile all the charcoals underneath your Dutch oven and with a little bit of vegetable oil to start things off. Put your marshmallow-sized pork chunks into the oil just to brown them. And once they're browned on a couple of sides, and then you'll put them aside. And while your oil is still hot, you can kind of use that opportunity to throw in your big chunks of poblano peppers and a rough cut whole onion and five or six or seven whole garlic cloves and a couple of serrano peppers or jalapeno peppers and about a half a handful of whole cumin seeds, and kind of give all that stuff a good toast. At that point, if your pan is really oily, you can take all the vegetables out and kind of wipe out your pan. But at that point, you can add the browned pork shoulder back into the pot, and then add your cooking liquid. So I usually just take along cans of chicken stock, but you can use whatever your favorite. If you're a really fastidious person and you have pork stock frozen in your freezer. By all means, use that. But chicken stock works really well. So you'll just kind of fill up the pot so that it's almost covering, but not totally covering all of the pork and vegetables that you put in there. I can't forget that you also need to add about 15 or 20 tomatillos, whole tomatillos that you've peeled and washed. I don't bother cutting them up or toasting them necessarily, because they just sort of end up disintegrating and making that kind of stew, the chili verde stew, and then you can and kind of salt and pepper the developing braise there, and move at that point you'll move about 2/3 of the coals that you use to fry the meat and the vegetables to the top of your Dutch oven. So a third of them will remain underneath. And in this case, you want about 12 coals on top and about 7 or 8 on the bottom. And you'll leave that to kind of simmer for an hour, at which point you'll change the coals. And you'll change the coals about 3 times. So it'll be a 3-hour braise. So you'll kind of, as those coals start to simmer down, then you can, start a new chimney of charcoals and replace them on the hour. And after 3 hours, it will just be like this kind of, really, really flavorful and tender chili verde that you can eat in tacos, or you can serve on rice, or just kind of eat it out of bowls. It's good to have some limes around and a little bit of cilantro around, but otherwise it's like, you're pretty set for serving 10 people really happily.
You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. That was Ian Harris talking with me about Dutch ovens. You can find a link to my entire interview with Ian, including a story where he decides not to heed the advice of Lawrence Ferlinghetti, on the Food Show page of the KBOO website. We turn now to a couple of folks who have recently moved to Portland and have brought with them an interesting and inspiring type of dinner party. Jesse Friedman and Laura Haddon started United Noshes in Brooklyn, New York, before moving to Portland, and have to date raised nearly $20,000 for the hunger prevention organization World Food Program USA. Jesse and Laura, welcome to The Food Show.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
It's great to be here.
I would have given a longer description about United Noshes in the intro, but I wanted to hear about it directly from you. So give us a little bit about the concept behind United Noshes.
So it is, as you described, a dinner party series, and we're cooking one meal from every country in the United Nations in alphabetical order. That's 193 members plus the two permanent observing states of the Holy See. which is the Vatican City, and Palestine. So that's a lot of food. We're 86 meals in, so we're just about halfway after a little over 3 years. And the idea is that we invite people into our homes, friends, families, strangers. We've met hundreds of people, ages 4 to 94, who've come to our table. We cook a meal for a cuisine that is often completely unfamiliar to all of us. But when possible, we love to have someone there who's from the country or has spent time there.
And you were mentioning that earlier, that tomorrow is World Food Day. And so I want to talk about that component of the dinners. You're raising money for an organization. Tell us a little bit about that.
So we actually ask our guests to bring, we have a suggested donation, $10 to $20. If people can't make it, that's fine. And what we do is we collect that money for the meal, and Jesse's employer, Google, matches the donation. So far we've raised $20,000, which is really nice because, you know, we're celebrating all these cultures, and a lot of these cultures and a lot of these countries have food scarcity issues. So it seems a little bit improper to sort of celebrate those cultures without sort of talking about the political realities of people facing that country.
Yeah, and what's amazing with World Food Program, they tell us that every dollar leads to 4 meals. So including the doubling, that means every dollar that a guest gives is 8 meals, which is, it's quite a lot. So that means we've raised enough money through our guests for 80,000 meals.
Wow. So if you look at each meal you've done, It's just exponential.
Yeah.
You guys get to enjoy an amazing meal, and then it just gets passed forward.
And it's great because it also sort of introduces our guests to sort of food scarcity as an issue and hunger as an issue, and connects them to something that they might not otherwise be engaged with.
So what kind of conversations are you having at these dinners? Because you're talking about, obviously, the country. I mean, you're talking about the cuisine, but then you're also talking about sort of these other issues.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, in some of the countries, you know, there's a real contrast between kind of what the average person on the street is going to eat on a daily basis and what we end up cooking. We're to make sure that we have enough variety and interest, and also kind of celebrate heritage, we try to focus on, like, what would be a big celebratory meal? What would be something that, you know, would be served at an anniversary or a birthday or something like that, if a family could kind of scrape it together? We've had particular challenges, say, we cook North Korea, which we've already done because it's officially the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. And that was a real challenge to figure out, like, what is actually North Korean cuisine beyond any flippant jokes you could make? Like, there is a real cuisine that it was from there. So we had to really dig deep to figure out what foods were originally from there. So it's an interesting opportunity to explore, and also to note the contrast between what's on our table and, you know, what these donation dollars we're raising are going to lead to, which is certainly a whole lot better than nothing, but not the sort of abundance of, you know, vegetables and meats and these other things that we enjoy.
And the conversation is also great, especially, as we mentioned, when we have people with some sort of experience or expertise in the country, because we can say, you know, how does this food compare to what you had or what you grew up with or your family's recipe? And people can, you know, oftentimes we get it right, but it's nice every once in a while to be like, actually, like, I don't know if this is regional variation, but, like, this tastes a little bit different. And then just sort of talk about what that means, or maybe what went wrong. And, you know, it's really a learning experience, and it's a kind of a dialogue. Meals where we don't have anybody with expertise, we're a little bit like, well, this followed the recipe, so, like, this is probably right. So it's neat.
My favorite memory with that is when we cooked the Cambodia meal, and a friend brought a few friends of hers who were Cambodian. They came in, they tasted my soup, they dumped the rest of the bottle of fish sauce in, and then we served dinner.
Nice. It sounds like that learning process is sort of, it's sort of what drove you originally to start this. Is that the case, or how did United Nauseous come together?
Well, part of it was that we were living in New York, and we really missed dinner parties and the fact that people don't really entertain at home. You're either going out to, like, a noisy bar. It's hard to sort of meet new people in sort of an authentic way and have good sort of quality conversations with people. And so part of it is we missed dinner party culture, and we thought, hey, you know, we could do that. And part of it, I think, was Jesse's always loved cooking and wanted sort of a new challenge to sort of expand his palate. And I'm actually a picky eater, so it was a good way to make me try stuff that I wouldn't otherwise try.
Yeah, I'd say that, you know, part of it was an idea of New York has all this incredible diversity of communities, and this is a great way to get out and see them. And I rode my bike to some places I never would have ended up before, and it was really great. But one thing that's been amazing, too, is just exploring around Portland, which, of course, is a much smaller place, but there actually still is quite a lot of diversity. I found African markets, Asian markets, you know, there's a large Eastern European community. You know, it's going to be a little more difficult to find that stuff here, but I'm pretty sure I'm gonna make do quite well with what's here, especially because it's a community that celebrates food diversity so much. I'm looking forward to getting more into that.
So coming up, the next meal is for Kazakhstan, mm-hmm. and you're going to be, you know, sourcing food for that. I'm curious then, for the actual night of the dinner, sort of take us through it. What happens from arrival to, you know, folks leave?
Well, before that, there's a lot of prep. First, we have to figure out who's coming to the meal, and, you know, we send out an invitation, and people respond, and we sort that out. Then it takes hours to figure out what to cook, especially for a country like Kazakhstan. There is not a ton of really good information out there. It's not like cooking Italian food where you can just go down to the bookstore and have your choice of hundreds of books. It takes a lot to dig in and then to use my spidey sense to figure out, is this a real recipe or is this like totally been adapted to the, you know, an American palate? And then, of course, it's going out and finding the food. You know, I'm having a heck of a time finding milk from a horse or a camel, which is traditionally fermented as the hospitality drink. I might just have to settle for goat's milk. And then, you know, spend the day cooking. And then, Laura, you want to take us through what happens when guests arrive?
Yeah, so guests arrive. We do a cocktail if there's a cocktail that's either originated in that country, or sometimes we do inspired by that country because not every country has a great cocktail. So sometimes we do that, or people bring, it's usually besides the cocktails, it's BYOB, people have a drink. Get around the table by the time that the meal is ready to be served, which we're trying to get that closer to the time when guests arrive, but often because Jesse's cooking them for the first time, we go a little over on that. Gather around the table. People do a series. We ask everybody to introduce themselves, do like a little icebreaker question, and then sort of dig into the food. Jesse points out what the food is, you know, what ingredients are in each food, talking about what people should eat if they have allergies, that sort of thing. And then, just dig in and sort of let conversation flow from there.
Yeah, and also we try to play music from the country. Spotify has been amazing for that. There's so much music available online that would have been nearly impossible to find even 10 years ago. So that's been, and when possible, we'll pull up like a radio station streaming from that country. But sometimes you just get American pop hits anyway, so we don't always do that.
Yeah.
That makes sense, that's the music that's playing over there. So I'm curious, you've mentioned Cambodia, you mentioned North Korea. Are there any other countries or dinners that stand out as either interesting or particularly challenging?
I think the single cuisine that surprised me the most was Georgia. That, you know, that little country in the Caucasus, the cuisine, just, I loved it. There's herbs and tomatoes and pomegranates, and it's just this kind of rich abundance of straight from the garden, very, very healthy sort of cuisine. It's not hot, it's not cold, it's not sweet, it's not savory. It's like all in this delicious in between. And then you just drink a ton of wine throughout the whole meal while Toastmaster gives these very long toasts, and that was a great time.
And I think that part of the challenge that you've encountered mostly as a person who preps the menu is actually countries with huge regional diversity. Countries like India or China, they, I mean, if you were going to do in terms of culinary influence, that should be split up and be several different meals. But the fact that we've sort of stuck to this idea of one meal for country, per country, you know, you have to narrow down. And how do you narrow down India to one meal? How do you narrow down China to one meal? And so I think that's been a huge challenge on that part.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's like I cooked maybe 14 different dishes for India, and I still didn't feel like I did enough. Like there were still major components of the cuisine that I totally left aside. Another approach I tried, this is what I did for Japan, was to not cook what people are most familiar with. You know, people are like, oh, great, you're doing sushi.
You're doing sushi.
No, there's
exactly.
way more than sushi in Japanese cuisine. So, you know, it was a summertime meal. So I made like a cold tofu dish. I made chicken yakitori. I did a cold noodles. And I found that really, it's a little more challenging because you have to dig a little deeper, but it's a lot more gratifying.
So it's a ways off, but what happens after you have that Zimbabwe dinner?
Well, we joke about we're just going to start over again. But considering,
well, it sounds like you can go back to India and China.
Yeah,
for sure.
Right. When we started, we thought this was going to take us 4 years, and we've just finished 3 years, and we're not halfway yet. So I think that, you know, first we're like, oh, then maybe we'll do another food project after this, and we might, but it is a long way off, so it's a little bit hard to think about. But I do occasionally think, like, I'm really going to miss this when this is gone. It's created a nice sort of social structure and a structure to sort of educational structure, too, about learning about different cultures, like actually sort of meditating on what each country in the world is like and what life is like there has been a really sort of interesting thought experience.
Yeah, it's true. I have spent the last couple of weeks thinking way more about Kazakhstan than I ever had before in my life. And you know, by the time we get through this entire project, we will have devoted at least a little bit of attention to every single spot in the world, which is a crazy awareness builder. And we've had experiences where we've met people from fairly obscure countries. And, you know, it's great to have a conversation topic that's about them. That's like, mm-hmm. I have at least done my best to try to enjoy your food, and this is my memory of it.
Yeah.
And if we forget what we cooked, we could just pull it up on our phone really quickly because I blog it all.
Right. I had a cab driver once from Burkina Faso, and I was like, oh, I've had food from your country. He's like, no, you haven't. I was like, yeah, give me a second. And I like looked it up on the blog and I read him the menu, and there was these little donuts. I can't remember exactly what they're called, but I told him the name of it. He's like, I used to sell those in the market. And it was like automatically we had like a 5-minute conversation about the donuts and like what it's like being a vendor of donuts and, you know, how early people get started. And so it's kind of a nice form of connection with people. Food, it's so primal. And so it's really nice to be able to also hear people's life stories through food.
Real quick, before I let you go, how can folks attend these dinners?
So we have a website. It's www.unitednoshes.com. Noshes is NOSHES.com. And we, on the top menu, there's a newsletter and sign up, and people can sign up there with their contact information. And we send about maybe one email a month, and we sort of announce the upcoming countries, and people can respond to those emails and say, you know, I'd really like to come to this particular meal. And what we do is we sort through all those invitations, and sometimes we have too many people for a given meal, in which case we'll tell people they'll be on the waiting list or they'll have priority for the next meal they want to come to. And so we track that all. So we love meeting new people through the project. I think that that's actually been one of the very, very best things.
I'd say also we're very open to ideas, particularly if an upcoming country has a big festival or holiday coming up. It's really fun to celebrate that, like for the Iran meal that corresponded with Nowruz, which is the Persian New Year. And that was really fun to celebrate. So if there are people in the area from a country starting with K, L, M, you know, you can see where we're going with this. You know, please get in touch, and we'd love to work with you and your community to figure out how to celebrate this together.
Great. Jesse and Laura, thanks so much for joining me on the food show.
Our
thanks
pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
To find more information about United Noshes, the aforementioned website, you can visit the food show page on the KBOO website. That's it for this episode of the KBOO Food Show. If you missed any of the show or want to listen back, you can find the episode archived at kboo.fm. I want to thank my guests, David Barber, Gabby DeLeon, Danielle Knott, Ian Harris, Jesse Friedman, and Laura Haddon for being on today's show. I also want to thank our fabulous engineer, Tammy. Stay with KBOO this afternoon, starting with Jazz Lives. And don't forget to tune in again the third Wednesday of November for another episode of The Food Show. Until then, I'm Chris Siegel. Thanks for listening.
Need some food in my belly. Need some drink for the dry in my throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away? Cause it ain't the right size or perfect, cause you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it ain't right to make people grow coffee when their families could be
And as Chris said, that's it for the public affairs programming for this morning on KBOO. This is KBOO Portland. In just a moment, Jazz Lives will join us, but before that, we've got to get to the KBOO Noon News coming right up.
This is KBOO Headline News at Noon for Wednesday, October 15th, 2014. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Patrick Wilson. In local news, Portland drug courts are using an innovative program to help drug and alcohol abusers convicted of federal offenses to reenter normal life. The voluntary program uses a team of people from the Federal Probation Office, U.S. Attorney's Office, Federal Public Defender's Office, and community treatment centers to work with prisoners. The objective is to provide a more humane and effective way of changing people's behavior so they halt the revolving door of using drugs, committing crimes, and going to prison.
Impero, a British software firm founded in 2002, will be opening a U.S. headquarters in Portland. The firm makes remote monitoring software for education customers with about 500 U.S. school districts currently using its product. The company products manage more than 4 million computers in 40 different countries, and it expects record-breaking growth this year.
In national news, the National Law Journal reports that the Supreme Court refused to hear a case to determine whether federal judges should be able to consider conduct for which a defendant is acquitted when sentencing. A minority of judges scolded the majority for not ruling in this long-running dispute. Scalia, Thomas, and Ginsburg disagreed with the majority decision.
The former mayor of Ferguson, Missouri, maintains that residents